Hello and welcome to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast. Well, I hope you're all doing well. It's the summer, so I'm afraid that we're not going to be doing as many podcasts as we would normally do, because apparently we've got to stop sometime, according to Scott. So, what I thought I'd do is I would put out a little webinar that I did for a group of people. Now, I did a whole day around the issue of childhood challenging violent and aggressive behaviour. So this is just one little discrete part of it that I thought might be interesting in relation to the research and how that kind of led to some more research and to some more research and kind of expresses all of the different findings that has then led us to where we are now. So I hope you enjoy it and I hope you have a fantastic summer. We're looking today, this morning specifically, at childhood challenging violent aggressive behaviour, lessons from research. And I think it's probably worthwhile sort of letting you know who I am and how I got to be where I am today and why I'm sort of speaking to you, because that seemed to make a lot of sense. As I say, the focus today for this morning is kind of going to bleed in nicely into this afternoon. So this morning I'm thinking about lessons from research and starting to unpack about what we know is going on in children start to think about the risk factors, rather than saying causes, because I think that's can be a bit misleading. We're going to talk about what are the risk factors in children's lives and children's, you know, circumstances that can lead to violent aggressive behaviour. But also starting to think about what that really looks like in from a family context and some of the challenges around why people or why parents and carers struggle to support or struggle to access support as well. Now, I think the caveat at the beginning is to say that I'll probably use the word parents a lot, but actually when I say parents, I'm talking about parents and carers, because it has to acknowledge there's a lot of children who aren't being cared for by their parents. And especially, I think, in this context, we have to be very conscious of the fact that, you know, there's 200,000 children in kinship care arrangements in the UK, give or take. There's no specific numbers. There's 70,000 children in fostering arrangements. There's 70,000 approximately children who are adopted, and then there's, you know, there's special guardianships in the midst of all that. There's a lot of children who aren't being parented by their parents. So, but when I say parents, I just kind of bear that in mind. So, starting at the very beginning, who am I? Well, I'm definitely not that picture, but I am a social worker. I've also been a foster carer. Prior to being a social worker, I've also been I am an adoptive parent. And I think that the reason I kind of put all of that in is because that reflects that I am, as much as I am, I work in this field and I support a lot of parents and carers, and obviously I've co-authored reports with Dr. Wendy Thorley, that I've got skin in the game. You know, this is stuff that has impacted on us as a family, and I sort of speak from personal experience. Now, I'm not going to particularly share very much of my personal experience, you know, just kind of maintain the confidentiality of my family. But a lot of the examples I give will be from real lives and real situations, because it's an incredibly tangible experience. Now, there's a few things on there. If you want to get in touch with me afterwards, you want to talk more about it, then you can through the Facebook page, the ACE Network Northeast, my own. I'm on Twitter and for different places. I also run an adoption fostering podcast and Let's Talk About podcast. As well, I think that as we talk about this stuff, we can often, it can be, it's not just out there, it's around here. And frequently when we talk about this, we discover that it's stuff that impacts on all of our families. It's not, it doesn't just sit with, you know, certain type of people. It covers a whole range of demographics. So again, be safe in yourself. Confidentiality, I mentioned that, and safeguarding. If you tell me things that that worry me, I might have to do something. So just so you know that, I'm a social worker and I work in fostering as it happens, but not particularly child protection, but child protection is an issue for everyone. So that was a big thing. Now, how we got to the research that we undertook, and I think it was because when I, as a foster carer and as a student social worker, really was interested in this field because I was conscious of the people I was rubbing shoulders with and some of the experiences of our family, was that there was just very, very limited, if any, information that I could kind of access about violent aggressive behaviour in children or child-to-parent violence, it was really clear that it was an issue that was known about but not necessarily written about. And I'm not talking decades ago, I'm talking, I'm talking sort of late 2000s, 2008, 2009, when it was an issue for us as a family. And I would often speak to my social worker and they'd sort of have sort of blank stares when I'd sort of stepped into university life as a social worker. I was a draftsman before that. I worked in construction for 20 years or so. I would go and look at the academic research and just discover that if you wanted to talk about domestic violence, you could see there was a really huge and comprehensive body of work. But when you start to look at the violence of children within a family context, there was really limited work, and often it was focused or it had a specific slant on different aspects of that, and frequently couched in adolescent to parent violence. And that was something that I was really conscious that, talking to lots of people and anecdotally knowing that that wasn't the case for lots of families, that actually the challenges that they were facing, they were not facing in teenagers, they were facing prior to that. And that was sort of wrong-footing the responses from services. It was wrong-footing them as well. It's also kind of disrupting normal expectations of families and child experiences. And so that was my starting point. And what that eventually led to is me with Dr. Wendy Thorley in 2016, basically putting out a very, 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 very rudimentary survey through SurveyMonkey, which was, was fun and games. And I said to Dr. Wendy, I said, look, I don't think we get free up to a 50. Do you think that'll be fine? She said, give your head a shake, this is going to be huge. And so within a week we got 250 responses or so, and that's from there we realized that actually this was an issue that was really quite prescient and people felt incredibly strongly about it. If you were living with this experience, you felt there was a huge sense of isolation, and that even just being given the opportunity to talk about it was really sort of grabbed with both hands. Now, that was predominantly within the adoption community because that was where my social media was based, and it sort of, I was in that little tiny little corner. So we started to think about this, and then over the next 18 months we wrote up three papers from that, which you can find in academia.edu. And then we went on to decide that actually we wanted to dig around a bit deeper. So we were really clear that what we'd been hinted at, and the more I'd spoken to people over the next couple of years, we discovered that actually this was an issue that was beyond just the adoption community, and if anything, was somewhat more hidden in other communities. If you think about it from a sort of a stigma point of view, that often adopters have this very, very convenient get out in that they can say, well, my child behaves like this, but this is not my biological child. My child came to me at five, and there's a lot of things happened before this child came to me, so they don't necessarily feel like the same levels of stigma or shame or perhaps a reluctance to talk about it. And also they've got pre-existing relationships in social care, so they've probably got friendly relationships with children's social workers, so that all of those factors sort of meant that it was an issue that was probably, even though it was still relatively limited conversations, they were quite comfortable to have broader conversations. So what then happened was we opened that up, and we really worked hard at widening that into a further community. So we got over 500 responses, and it was predominantly from people with biological children, and that really developed our understanding. And we continued to look hard around the research, and there was a sort of a growing sense of research, or a growing body of research, but still very limited. And that led us to rewrite the book from the 2018 survey we wrote, Let's Talk About Childhood Challenging Violent and Aggressive Behaviour, which is a mouthful, in the home. And that book is available on Amazon if you want to read it. It's a very interesting kind of unpicking of some of the stuff that we found. And then we trawled ourselves, I trawled myself around the country, sort of talking to lots of different communities about that. And then in the midst of all that, we bumped into the police, and the police were quite surprised that we were doing this, and actually it was an issue that they were dealing with on a daily basis. The long and short of it is that we then undertook a year's study, or just short of a year's study, where we asked them to give us the data that they were getting, because they were reporting from anecdotally from officers and through some of their recording, they could see that it was an issue that was, as I said, daily. But that was also linked to a domestic homicide review of Sarah, which again you can Google. I've not particularly mentioned it because we've got time, isn't it? It's quite limited. There was a domestic homicide review in 2016, and it was of a case of a single mother who had been raising her concerns in relation to the behaviour of her son for a period of approximately, you know, well, over a period of years, and she'd sort of raised concerns to broad groups of professionals, and it had been framed very much in terms of his mental ill health or her inability to parent, and she was put consistently on your standardized parenting courses, which are, you know, which can be good, but actually his behavior was quite extreme, and ultimately that led, or ultimately she was murdered by her son. And the Northumbria police were very keen that they were able to reflect on the findings of the domestic homicide review and were able to start to try and do something differently. So those are that's the main body of research I'm going to rattle through today, and I'm going to try and get that all done in the next sort of 30 minutes. But you can find that all online, and that's available. These slides will be available at the end. I'm not sure how we'll get them to. I think, well, we've got all your email addresses, and we know who should be here, so we'll send them out to people. So don't necessarily get into a frenzy trying to write down all of the information. And as well, it's worth noting that the slides, I've made them quite dense and rich because I'm conscious that you'd rather be looking at slides than me sat in my little office. So that's the research we're going to draw on, and starting at the very beginning, I think that it's worth starting to think about what do we mean when we talk about childhood challenging violent aggressive behaviour, because we can look at a whole raft of different definitions, and if you were to Google CCVAB, you'd probably find not that much, but if you were to Google child to parent violence, you might get more, but you might get it from a certain part of the community. Recently I've seen child to parent abuse, which can actually kind of encompass a whole raft of different experiences of, you know, potentially older children, adult children, and elderly parents. Childhood violent behaviour, which is a phrase that is used within the special educational needs community, CVB. Child to parent violence and aggression. Adolescent to parent violence and aggression. There's no standardised definition, and I think that it's something that's been a bit of a frustration, because actually it is a really, because of the nature of the experience and the phenomena, that people feel very passionate about it, and they I know for some families that the child to parent abuse, the word abuse is really potent, and they just are really uncomfortable with sort of labeling their children as abusers, even though the behavior is by anyone's definition abusive. So what you find is the definition of this becomes really important, and the research reflects that as you look through it. So a really brief history of the research is that the history is really short, that the first kind of area where time it was defined was in by Harbord and Madden, and they identified the phenomenon of parent battering, which I don't like, but I also find that it is actually a really good description. You know, it feels very visceral, but actually it does, often parents will describe it in those terms. Then there's limited research. Here we've got the next one from Cottrell and Monk, and this is 2004. Any harmful act by a child, whether physical, psychological or financial, which is intended to gain power and control over a parent or caregiver. I'm reading that because I'm conscious that there's a few people on the phone that may not be able to see, or people are maybe using their phones, their devices. But that is a definition that's really stuck quite hard and fast to this phenomenon, and it's a definition that often is referred to, but often in speaking to parents, if this was a group of parents and I was doing this session and I put that up, you find that we might have a debate at this point, because there's the language of that sort of provokes a response depending on on those individuals. But often the word intended becomes really potent for parents. And this is a theme throughout all of the research that we've done, is that we constantly come back to this word intention. Is the behaviour of a child intentional to try and control a parent, or is it a reaction? Is their behaviour a reactionary? Is there a, you know, is their violence proactive, or is it there? Is it reactive? Is the aggression proactive or reactive? And that's a constant question that families struggle with, and that also how they perceive that also influences what they do and how they respond to it, and also how they seek help. So that is a definition that's very, very important and very holds very fast. And it's worth noting that definition came out of some research that was done into adolescents, predominantly young men who themselves had experienced violence and aggression through domestic violence of their fathers. So that perhaps reflects then why that definition, that intended, feels perhaps not necessarily true for all families. But we're going to sort of unpick causes as we go on. This one, often parents and families feel very, very, feel that this kind of encapsulates some of the issues, especially in relation to parents who feel that they must adjust their own behaviour or accommodate threats or anticipations of violence. So even before we start, we find that the research has got a whole raft of definitions that people feel either comfortable or uncomfortable with and don't necessarily reflect the underlying causes of the behaviour or some of the nuances around how people respond or react to that behaviour. And so here we go, the 2016 survey, which I confess was, you know, it was 4 years ago and I just did it on a whim on a sort of a December afternoon, if I'll be honest with you. It was just seemed like a really good idea at the time. It sort of set me on a path that's kind of become sort of almost consumed my life. But what we found at the very beginning was that just from the most fundamental point, that people were saying this is an issue for all ages of children. And if anything, this stereotype of it being a teen issue was seen to be untrue amongst the community that responded. And again, it's worth reflecting that, you know, on those slides, we used that definition, the Cottrell definition with the word intended in, because we were kind of at the start and we didn't really appreciate the nuances. But one of the key things for me is that we found that people were identifying behaviour that people were considered to be beyond normal and violent aggressive, fell into this category at under the age of five or five and under, and then with a really high prevalence through into sort of middle childhood, 6 to 11, and then a decrease, and they actually was, you know, shown there to be less. And you just people start to think that that actually creates a really odd phenomenon, because when you look at all of the literature, I mean, if you Google this now, you will find that the Home Office has very clear guidance. The 2014-15 guidance from the Home Office is around adolescent to parent violence. And I think that as well, that we can all have a level of, we can all sort of touch the idea that teenagers, you know, can be aggressive, reactive, and that, you know, often that's all well within the bounds of normal behavior, but sometimes that can slip over. But we all have a level of empathy because we've all probably been teenagers, and we can all kind of go, well, I remember being really frustrated, or I remember, and so we can go, well, that feels right. But actually, when we start to talk about younger children, then that feels much more alien and much more outside of our experience. So what we also found, thinking about the impact on parents, was that a lot of families were really clear that actually that there was a huge impact across their lives, that there was an impact on their health. And you can see that from this survey, we were asking really blunt questions. You know, we didn't necessarily unpick whether that was mental or physical health, finances, employment, relationships. And you can see there that it wasn't just one. People were reflecting that the impacts on their lives were across a whole range of things. And I think the conclusions that we came out and from the training that we developed from this was that often people are living in really complicated situations. And I was speaking to a friend recently who's worked in a school and said that it was only when she sort of saw parents coming with a black eye and her making a presumption about domestic violence to only discover that it was domestic violence in the home, but it was from a child, and having to really recalibrate the level of violence that was occurring. and seeing the impact on that individual as they were trying to care for a child. And I think that's one of the nuances that we when we think about domestic abuse, we know that often it's complicated relationships with levels of coercion and control between men and women, and women and men, predominantly women experiencing that. However, when we think about, when we start to think about violence and behavior that's challenging for parents and carers, that they are legally bound to their children. They don't have the As a society, we fully expect parents to look after their children, and they have a legal responsibility to look after those children and care for those children and raise them well, you know, in an environment that supports their development, appropriate development, healthy development. However, all of a sudden, we've got a situation where children are, parents who feel that their child is abusive, but they are legally bound to them, which creates a very complicated dynamic for those individuals, those parents or carers. I think it's worth noting that we sort of asked people to, we gave people the option to say, well, what does that look like? You know, when we talk about violence, are we talking about, you know, children who just are a bit pushy? But we see across there now, I'm looking across to my screen here, and we say bruises and scars. You know, we see lots of things, you know, people being reported for child protection, excluded from school, scared of my child, violence to sibling, not being believed, isolation, lack of ability to fit into school. And I think that on the right-hand side, we see the probably the most significant, which was that there was an effect on siblings, and that was reflected all the way through, that we saw that people were incredibly concerned in relation to the impact on other children in the house. The complexity, knowing that in a, you know, from a social worker child protection perspective, that if a child is living in an environment where there's violence and aggression, we would consider that to be a safeguarding concern, rightly so. But we often focused on adults, not necessarily on other children. And not necessarily younger children, children who are maybe 6 and 11. So we started to see some really interesting stuff. And as I say, we then went on to ask some more questions in the 2018 survey. And we were very, very keen to sort of start to unpick some of this stuff. I'm just looking at the time, making sure I'm not speaking too slowly, because this is there's a lot to get through. So we, the second survey were there, you can see that we realized that actually we were, it was predominantly biological parents that we went to. Again, we asked the question more nuanced about how many children were in the household when there was violence and aggression, and how many, and what were the ages of those children. And we saw that actually there was a really, there was the clear peak for whether there was one or more than one child in the house that was this age of 6 to 9. We also asked the age of the people who were actually writing, who were raising the concerns or completing the survey. And what we saw, that there was, the demographic was of older parents. Now this kind of starts to make sense when you start to think about what are the causes, or what are the underlying risks for violent and aggressive behaviour in children. And we know that there's risk for older parents who have biological children, that there's a increased risk of special educational needs. But we also know that if you're a kinship carer or an adoptive parent or a foster carer, that you are generally older. You know, adopters are fairly obvious that they will have probably tried a few different routes to parenthood, and sort of adoption is often the last one, and also the one that takes a bit of time, so people are older. Kinship carers, predominantly older family members, you know, grandparents, older siblings. So that was then interesting to reflect, that we're actually seeing an older cohort of parents, which then starts to raise questions about the parenting style. You know, I grew up in the 70s, so my parenting style is pretty much that sort of post-war, do as you're told, pretty harsh justice, but loving, but very stoic, just get on with it sort of attachment. And we started to, I think the one of the other areas that we started to look at was when we started to think about the impact on children, that we started to ask people about the impact of violence and aggression on the relationships and partners and other children in the home. And we saw that there was a lot of, that a child's behaviour then created a very complex system in the home. What should be a safe place for everyone, it became a very unsafe place for everyone, that people's focus became switched onto the child with the behaviour that either trying to trying to manage that behavior, and that managing could be then complicated in that it might be placating a child, it might be pussyfooting around a child, it might be toe-to-toe trying to lay in boundaries. But often a whole family then became consumed with one child's specific needs. The other thing that I think was sort of a moment of revelation for us was this idea that this question that we asked was, does a child have a special educational need? And the answer came back from over 500 of the responders, which was the vast majority, was that yes, they did, or they were in the process of getting one. And so that was regardless of whether they were biological or they were children through kinship care or through adoption or fostering. Excuse me. So we saw that actually there was a known link, but actually it's not a cause, it's a risk. And I think that there's a higher risk with those children. And so that started to make us sort of really think about what were the underlying risks for children, what were the roots to this sort of behaviour. So you can see there through that list that we're talking about learning difficulties, dyslexia, dyspraxia, moderate learning difficulties, communication difficulties, global developmental delay, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which again we know is hugely underdiagnosed, and it's still an area where we're trying to get out a grasp of what is going on. But we know that that can significantly impact on a child's ability to comprehend, to regulate their own emotions. Obviously the first one is reactive attachment disorder, autistic spectrum disorder, attention, we can go through and we see that actually that all of these were children who had in some way didn't just appear out of nowhere. They were children that had either complex biology or complex biography. So that was probably a key moment of revelation when we were thinking about the children whose behaviour was difficult, that actually that these are not just, that there's much more to this than just sort of a simplistic view of parents not being very good, which we'll come to, but is kind of a key feature of this world, of this, which when you think about the serious case review of the mother that was killed, that was returned to again and again by professionals who were saying, actually, you're not doing this very well. Now, that's a complex dynamic because often she was struggling and every tool she was being given was the wrong tool. And so that she was being asked to parent a child with additional needs in a way that was not accommodating those additional needs. And that, from what we know about parenting, which again we will come on to, and if you're coming to this afternoon, then we'll start to really unpack how can parenting influence the behavior of a child. And often that sounds like an obvious thing to say, but how can it negatively or positively influence, and how good parenting can also look like bad parenting. So we, from the book, we came up with some clear recommendations, but also understanding that that with that focus being on other conditions, that there was often a comorbidity, that we needed to really just see that we needed to see this as a case-by-case basis. And I think that that's probably the one defining feature of this, is that it is complicated, that there is no hard and fast rules, that there's no kind of simple magic wand that says it's because of this, that this, it's because of this condition, it's because of this experience, that those were certainly risk factors could be identified. But actually, it was really important to get a really good understanding of what was going on in the home, and that any solution had to be tailored to the specific needs of the child, but also of the parent, understanding where the parent was coming from, why the parent was responding in a certain way, and to understand that. What we also saw was that there was a reluctance for professionals to identify a specific, there is a, within the ICD-10 and ICD-11, we saw there was a conduct disorder that actually, where children's behaviour very frequently met the criteria for that condition. However, that we would see that that the guidance would recommend that if a child has autistic spectrum disorder but meets the criteria for a conduct disorder, that actually you wouldn't give two diagnoses. You would just say autistic. They have ASD, so that often the condition, you know, the conduct disorder condition is hidden, or it's just not identified or not acknowledged in of itself. Now, I think if you go to the US, you probably see that there are groups that kind of focus solely on the conduct disorder and kind of highlight that as the primary issue. But actually in the UK, it's just not seen and not known about, or it's, I don't think I've met any child in the UK who's ever had that diagnosis. But clearly conduct disorder in the context of home is a clear issue for many, many families. And so often it's seen as a facet of something else. So there's a sort of an acceptance that, oh, well, or, you know, and I'm not saying this, but, you know, there's a sort of an acknowledgement, well, autistic children can be violent. And you go, well, that's not, but not all autistic children are violent. So we need to maybe have a bit of a more nuanced understanding of that, and rather just kind of, and just say, oh, well, it's just a feature of autism. Well, that's not good enough, really. I think that we need to sort of scratch around a bit more than that and have a bit of a more nuanced understanding of what is going on in children. And now, as a personally, I find it, you know, I find labels quite unhelpful, and I think I'm really cautious that they can dehumanize children. But also I think as professionals, if we start to use them, you know, like I had a conversation with someone on, you know, talking about reactive attachment disorder, and she was saying, oh, you know what these rad kids are like, and I was going, please just stop, because it's a child, it's a, you know, and I know I'm a social worker, and I wear corduroy and I've got a man bag and all that stuff, you know, I'll flounce around drinking herbal tea, but actually it matters, words really matter. So I think that some of our language has got to be really, really moderated, and we've got to stop dehumanizing children. That's me, my little soapbox off, forgive me, I'm prattling on about that. So we then moved on to kind of, the police became very clear, and actually one of the challenges was with all of this information is that it's all well and good just kind of, you know, thinking big thoughts, writing nice words, and having a few, you know, doing the odd presentation here and there, but actually you want to see effective change. And I have to commend the police, that the police of all of the services that we've worked with, the police have been the most proactive, and that they're very keen to get ahead. Added to that, in the survey and the research that we did, was we'd ask specifically families, you know, what services have you been to? And they would consistently say, we've been to, you know, police, we've talked to school, we've talked to the GP, we've talked to CAMHS, we've talked to children's social care, not always willingly to all of these people, but out of a desperation. And consistently people were saying that their response they'd received from the police, 70% of people who'd contacted the police said they found their response helpful, which was counterintuitive, because I kind of had this, maybe it is a stereotype that the police were potentially going to be the least helpful, or the kind of the most draconian. But often families came and said, actually, we tried this one, we tried that one, tried the other one, but the police came, the police helped, the police, and actually the response from the officer in that moment of violent aggressive behaviour was often incredibly empathic, responsive. It brought a real peace and calm to the house, and which is interesting, also had a level of sort of calm authority. And again, this afternoon we'll talk about some of the approaches around nonviolent resistance, but also brought a real focusing on what the law said, not necessarily what children's social care policy was. So that was around being focused on the needs of the family, the police being focused on the needs of the family and the needs of everyone, and weighing everyone in the house by the same measure, so that if a mother has got a black eye, then the mother is a victim. And the mother, you know, whether the child is sorry or not sorry is irrelevant. The child has committed, you know, has perpetrated that assault. So they saw it in those terms and were very much led by the needs of the parents, frequently, which parents found incredibly refreshing, but also the children, sort of recalibrated children. So we did, over a 10-month period, the police recorded every single incident where they'd been called out to behaviour of a child where the parent or caregiver was asked for help. So they were all 999 calls. And to be honest with you, it was incredibly harrowing, and we read some accounts that were way beyond what I'd expected. And I'm pretty, you know, I've immersed myself in this for a long time, but here's one example, you know, of a child that had, a family had gone to social care. Social care had said, well, we need to safeguard the family, so we're going to bring him to care. Then they'd phoned back and said, no, we're not going to do that. The child had then dysregulated. The social worker had said, take the child to the pictures, which I think the parent was somewhat, I think it was a grandma, was absolutely beside herself saying, what on earth? And then the child had dysregulated to the point where she'd broken down her bedroom wall. And at that point, she called the police. And I think in all of this, that the reality is that people are living in with extremes of behaviour from children that are almost incomprehensible. And I can't imagine living in a home environment where a child has done that, because they couldn't go into social care. So we're talking about really complicated dynamics, and actually quite frightening for the adults, because they were upturning the sort of the societal norms in relation to how children behave, and also how parents behave, and how parents are sort of, there's a kind of a universal acceptance, regardless of your culture or, you know, faith, or that actually children should be controlled by their parents, you know, appropriately controlled, and that parents are in charge. And what we saw increasingly through the police report was that there was a lot of parents who were really struggling, and that we recorded that's what it says. So there was over 220 children involved in 515 incidents over a 10-month period. Again, the ages of children. So this is it. I think this is interesting in that it reflects that what I think I said at the beginning was that there's this understanding that it's an adolescent problem. But sort of talking to families and talking to people is that actually it isn't. It's only at that point where people feel that they cannot contain it any longer, or that it becomes threatening to the point where they are fearful and feel or they become desperate to call the police. Because I think at this moment, you know, if you can just stop for a second and think, what behavior would, if you're a parent, what behavior would your child have to display for you to call the police? At what point would you think, I need the police here now? And I think we can sort of understand that in older children. But on this list, we see children aged 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. But actually, even at those ages, you know, I think the understanding is that once you call the police, that you lose control of your home and you lose control of what happens next. That, you know, that anything could happen. You know, that we don't know. It's not, most people don't have police in their lives. It's not normal. And we're not sure how the police will respond. So again, it's important, I think, to reflect that this doesn't mean that it's only an issue for this group of children. I think it's only an issue. This is at the point where people feel they can't manage anymore and they need significant help, or they need, you know, they've called 999. We looked at the incidents across the year, and I think this is probably the most confusing and perplexing, or intriguing. I think intriguing is perhaps the best way of describing it, is that we saw a pretty steady number of incidents through the year. We saw an increase in July leading up to the summer holidays, and then we saw a decrease in August, and then a kind of back to an average sort of position in September, and then, you know, then this decrease. And the reason January is short there is because it was the first few days of January. But the question is, what, you know, the obvious thing in August is what's happening. Well, it's school, isn't it? The children are not being required to attend school. And so there's a great deal, there's a lot to question as to why there's fewer incidents in the summer. And fortunately, the police have continued to record all of the incidents. And if I can find time with, you know, and Dr. Wendy, if I can persuade Dr. Wendy, then we will hopefully look at what the frequency has been throughout lockdown, because I think that's the big question mark, is what is the impact of school on this phenomenon? What is going on, and why are we seeing children? Why do we see a reduction? Is it a one-off blip? Is it, you know, is it that children are not going to school, or is it that children are not at home? Children are, you know, playing out because the weather's better. There could be a whole raft of reasons, and we kind of would like to get the bottom of it, because the lockdown will be children at home without going out, at least in the first few months. But anecdotally, I've had a lot of people come to me saying this has probably been the calmest our family's ever been. I have seen some incidents, but I've also seen a lot of families going, this is just, you know, we're not that sure whether we want our children to return to school, as was anyway, because of the peace we've seen in our household, which is totally understandable. Again, this is in relation, if you recall, in the second survey we did, we looked at the number of incidents and the number of children with special educational needs or diagnosis of some such, and we saw that there was almost universal. This wasn't reflected here, but it has to be noted that the police weren't necessarily asking that question, and also that parents were self-reporting, so that they may, you know, it's not uncommon in situations people to say, oh, my son's got ADHD, and everyone believes them, and they only discover that they only just think they've got ADHD, and because they don't necessarily understand their behaviour. So what we saw was that actually, but again, a higher prevalence there within the sort of the general population of children, 30%, as opposed to approximately sort of 10% of children that have special educational needs. It also worth noting that 89 incidents, or 17%, involved substance misuse by children. And I think, again, that isn't a surprise to see that there's that risk there, that link between sort of substance misuse. But again, what we know about substance misuse, there can be a whole host of underlying issues in relation to that around self-medicating, and children who, you know, you are getting something from that medication, what they're getting from it, and does that reflect on their underlying issues or underlying challenges in their circumstances or biology. Really briefly, that what we saw was that the police were incredibly led by the parents in relation to what they then did next, and one incident we followed through where there was repeated incidents across the year, and the parents consistently said, under no circumstances will we don't want to criminalise our child. We don't want to criminalise our child. We're again and again and again. And then one day the family sort of, there was a tipping point where where the abuse and the physical behaviour was then pointed towards one of the child's siblings. And that was sort of a line in the sand for parents. And that anecdotally and through a lot of the research, we see that as soon as you get to that point, that families go, right, well, actually, we're in a position where we have to protect the younger child, or the older child, even. That child needs protecting, and consequently, we will, for this family that we were following, they at that point gave a statement and asked that there was a, that was followed through courts. That was for a 14-year-old, so a bit older, but actually we see that the police are responding and seeing behaviour that would be clarified as violent aggressive. I'm just looking at the time. I keep looking at my watch. I think that the key thing that we saw was that frequently the police were being called to incidents where families were at the end of their rope, but actually incidents where you thought that actually this is someone else's duty. We saw that the police were, we interviewed police officers, and I can recommend the report. It's fantastically interesting. And it starts to unpick some very interesting issues around sort of proactive aggression and reactive aggression. And it's a good read. And all of the reports have got summaries as well, if you kind of want to cut to the chase with those. I think they're all available online. So if you Google them, or if you go on Amazon, if you want to buy them in book form, that would be appreciated. Every little helps. I think that, again, we need to know more about the risk, the link between school exclusion and incidents. And the police in Northumbria at least have sort of committed to continuing to record the data. And we hopefully are kind of trying to squeeze the Home Office to do that across the country, because I think that is one of the issues that we've not really touched on as we look at the research, is that actually how much, how often, what is the prevalence, what is the frequency of this? And so if you look at something like Adoption UK did a survey amongst their members who are all adoptive parents, and 65% said at some point through their child's life that they'd experienced violence and aggression. If you talk in certain communities within children who have autism, you see up to 30%. Everyone's got an opinion depending on their agenda, and I think that if you talk to people and you start to ask people around you, everyone will know someone who's got a niece who, you know, freaks out, or a nephew who does this. So everyone knows someone anecdotally. So I think that we're probably at about 10% at some point through the childhood. And I think until we know that, then I think that not knowing how prevalent it is then impacts on the services that we have available and the interventions that we have available, because I think that it's been very much untalked about. And when I was sort of at the beginning of unpacking this research, I was asked to speak at a social work conference with Helen Bonick, who's another author on the issue. And the first question I asked was, well, who here works with children who are sometimes violent and aggressive towards their caregivers? And obviously they'd all come to our cinema, so they're all going to say yes, so it's 250 plus people. And then the next question is, well, who here has had training on this? And it's not an exaggeration to say there's the very most there was 5 people who had. Now I think that situation's probably different now. However, we're still in a position where there are no universal interventions, and what interventions we have are questionable in some respects, or they're very focused on a specific type of or a specific risk factor. So we might have it in relation to children who've experienced domestic abuse or children who lived in, you know, specific environments. So again, it's very much a one size does not fit all and will never fit all. Sometimes it's a parenting issue and sometimes it's a child issue, and more than often it's issue around both. What we kind of drew from this was that actually that each different professional group sort of saw this in very different terms, and I'm going to put that up there. I'm going to talk for a couple of minutes on that. So that from a medical point of view, that it was often seen as we need to fix the child, that, you know, that traditional medical sort of perspective is that there is something wrong with this child and we need to fix the child, so therefore we will give the child a pill, or we will do some sort of therapeutic input to the child, that it was behavioural, it was attachment, you know, FASD, that actually it was all dumped entirely on the child. Social care view was often a bit more complicated, but often would see that it was perhaps developmentally normal. So, you know, we all can appreciate that toddlers and, you know, universally can be a bit tantrumy, that they are a bit impetuous, a bit fisty, a bit handy, a bit slappy, a bit scratchy, and that's a developmental phase that they go through. But we train and we teach and we support them through that to a place where they see that it's not appropriate to lash out if they don't get what they want. But what we know about some children is that they don't get that training, they don't get that moment of, you know, their development, that the parenting is perhaps dysfunctional or not present, and that what is taught by parents is then and learned by children is not taught and is not learned. And so we see, you know, if you work, you know, thinking about violent aggressive behavior in the context of classrooms, what we see is that often children can display really complex issues, in that you can have a very academic appropriate milestones academically, children who are articulate and bright and funny and witty and fun and engaging, who then tantrum like toddlers when they don't get what they want, literally tantrum. But that tantrum, you know, what is a tantrum in a 2-year-old is very much manageable and non-threatening, but in a 14-year-old can be quite very destructive and very frightening for staff members. And this disconnect, as someone who's having to work in that environment, and for a parent as well, that you're seeing these very two manifestations of behaviour, that you've got a child who, you know, is using very grown up words, you know, some, you know, dropping the F-bomb, like, you know, like she's Samuel L. Jackson, but actually it is the behaviour of a much smaller child. Developmentally, you would kind of go, well, they are literally tantruming. And that's the only way to describe it. So very complicated for people to work with. Educational view, kind of, it sits quite clearly in that sort of, this is special education needs. And police view, the police view this in the terms of what is the law and what is appropriate. I think for adolescents, it sits within the their clear understanding of, you know, adolescent apparent violence, which is Home Office guidance. And I can recommend looking up the Home Office guidance, because it's got a, it's really short, which is always good. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but on the very back page, it's got it's got particular advice for different professionals, or kind of insight into their, what they need to do and how they need to support. But on one level, police are expected to prosecute criminal behaviour. And that's, again, a taboo for why children, parents don't. So when we think about the impact on parents, and I think we're building towards the end of this little bit, and I'm going to give you all 5 minutes to kind of go away and have a think, and maybe get a cup of coffee, and then we'll kind of rattle through the second half of what are the risk factors for children and what are we seeing, and sort of summarising all of this, is that frequently we see that parents do not want to talk about it. They just feel incredible amounts of shame, that often for biological parents, there can be this really complex dynamic where they feel responsible for any negative experiences of their children, and they may be responsible. They may have had, you know, this, you know, they may have made poor choices or found themselves in difficult circumstances or had no choices, and that then that has then impacted on the behaviour of their children. I think every parent, if you are a parent, you know yourself that actually you turn yourself inside out over your children. But if the behaviour of your children is extreme and violent and aggressive, then that is then magnified, and you feel a high level of shame. And I think that that then leads to this stigma. I do a lot of work in this field, but, you know, I'll go out to the shops, well, I won't go out to the shops at the moment, but, you know, you go out to the shops and you see a toddler tantruming, and you kind of, your instinct is to say, where's the parent, where's the carer, who's in charge of this child? And I think that as a society, which I mentioned before, is that we have this expectation that parents should, or carers, or whoever's responsible for this child, should have control of this child. And for some children, they're not willing or not able to accept that control at certain points. And that then puts the parents in this kind of role of inadequate. And I was actually, you know, I think that that, well, that can be really complicated, and we often do it. And, you know, we saw it with the domestic homicide review, which is, you know, again, it's an extreme case. You know, it is as extreme as you can get, where, you know, a child kills a parent, but the parent was consistently seen as an inadequate parent. There was no consideration to the complexity of the situation. You know, I think, I can't remember the exact number, but it was sent on numerous parenting courses, you know, standardised parenting courses, that said, you know, naughty steps. No, we don't call them naughty steps. I'm a terrible social worker. Timeout. Sit there, think about this. I'm going to leave you alone while you do this. Consequences, you know, you're five, so I'm going to sit you for 5 minutes. That your boundaries are firm and fixed and inflexible, that you are consistent. There's nothing wrong with being consistent, but for some children, you need to have a much more nuanced understanding of what's going on in them, and you need to kind of have that flexibility to meet them where they're at. So we see that. That's one reason my parents don't. Child protection, also, as well, a reason why people don't call the police, the reason that they don't talk about it, is because actually, if you're not in control of your child, then you've got you run the gamut of having child protection social workers come to the house. And that is, families I've worked with have talked about the abject terror of that, because you lose control. A social worker, they can come in and they can, you know, you don't get a decision. You know, if you don't let them in, you're then seen as a belligerent parent, or a not willing to work with services. You're in a position where you have no choice, basically. And as a parent, that, you know, I'm sure everyone here who's a parent would not want a social worker sat in your front room looking at how you parent. I've got nothing to hide, but actually that level of scrutiny is, and we're all human, that level of scrutiny is just not particularly helpful. And criminalisation, that parents won't get in touch with services because if they, you know, they don't want their children to get a criminal record. Again, we're back to this idea that children, parents are bound legally to their children. And if those children are abusive, then that creates a really complicated dynamic that parents feel incredibly kind of trapped by. Now, I'm going to leave this slide up and I'm going to...